Today is Wednesday, August 23rd, 2023. This is part 19 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Alan Malmquist. And Alan spells his last name M-A-L-M-Q-U-I-S-T, first name A-L-L-E-N. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Alan. How are you today?
Good morning, Tom. I'm just fine.
Excellent. Alan, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes.
Thank you. Alan, can you pick up the work you did in the Lees Ferry area, both up by the launch ramp area and over at Lonely Dell, the ranch properties, working on the building maintenance that you did? You mentioned the lead paint, but gosh, I think you must have done all kinds of other stuff.
Oh, I did. You see, it was at least 5 or 6 years full time that I was working on the buildings.
So wow, 5 or 6 years full time.
Every building there I did major work on.
Wow.
Completing what the other groups started. And it was a big job. It included 11 of the historic structures and lots of volunteer assistance. And like I say, every one of the buildings had work that I did on it. And I thought I'd start with the and give an example of what the Park Service does and how they approach buildings, what I did to continue that and see where it goes.
Super.
The first building was the Samantha Cabin up at the ranch, which was the old log cabin, and built by Warren Johnson for his wife, Samantha, when he came to run the ferry for the Mormon Church in the early 1870s. But it had a lot of importance to me because I knew several people who had been born and raised in that cabin.
Oh, wow.
And from over in Moccasin and Fredonia. And it was very important to them. And they have all told me about it before I even got there. And so to do work on there was important. And I don't know who decided to start the official projects there, but they did. It was one of the first three or so at the ranch that what they did was the building was log cabin, but the logs were laid right on the ground.
Okay.
Which meant that they were going to rot and decay and have occasionally termites. Termites are not a big problem there out in the desert, but there were some in the past.
Hey, Alan.
Yeah.
Can I interrupt just for a minute here? Is this the cabin, and did you mention this maybe in an earlier interview, that the logs of this cabin were actually from one of the ferry boats?
Yes, that's the same cabin.
Okay.
See, Warren Johnson built the original cabin there when he left in the 1890s, and Emmett was called to run the ferry.
Right.
He rebuilt that cabin with the remains of the mining raft. So
okay, so this is after Warren Johnson built it, Emmett rebuilt it.
Rebuilt it.
I see, thank you. Okay.
And he said that he took it down, used some of the logs and other buildings that he was using on the ranch, and used some of the logs from the boat that came down, the raft from the river. It's a mixture of the logs. If you really look at them, they were cut at different times, and obviously different people, different locations. So, but it's still historic.
And did Emmett do the same as Johnson, meaning put the lowest logs right on the ground?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And so two of the base logs there when we started, and this was in, I don't know what I told you last time, 2002 or three.
Okay.
Probably 2002 when we started. And they jacked the cabin up and lifted it off the logs that were on the bottom there. Two of them were bad. Two had been replaced early in the 70s, but these other two needed to go. And they, we had a kind of a boneyard of old lumber and logs and stuff that we kept up in the side canyon, and actually had the logs that, you know, it's just the two logs that they always said, well, we'll have to use these somewhere someday, and they turned out to be perfect to use down under the cabin.
Oh, nice.
So they put the cabin, put the new logs, turned them, cut them exactly, notched them the same, and so they fit underneath, and put the other one down. Preserved them as well as possible with various chemical preservatives that's like a weather seal that doesn't do a lot, but it's better than nothing under there.
So there, and, hey, Alan, was there any discussion of saying, let's put in a small concrete footing around here so that we don't have to, going forward, replace these logs? Or was the discussion, this is traditional, this is how it was done. You pick up the cabin, you replace the logs, you put it back, or you tear the whole thing down, you rebuild
That's exactly the latter was the case. It was discussed, and I was surprised they didn't do a little more, but the decision was to do it the way it was built and go for it and see what happens.
Okay.
Okay. The other issue was the roof, which had failed, and it was a shake roof, you know, shingles.
Okay, so roof. it wasn't like a dirt, like a sod roof kind of thing.
No, not at this point. Not in
2000
something. It was and the last owners of the place, in fact, the consortium, they put the shingle roof on it. Mainly because they thought that's what log cabins had to have. And all the cabins they'd seen around the country and in the mountains had shingle roofs, shake roofs. So
just because it's done in Colorado, let's do it here.
Yeah.
Okay.
So what that roof had failed, the shingles had not been maintained or no coating, and a lot of them were missing, and that was taken off.
Okay.
We had the old pictures of the building from back in the 1890s, and it had a composition asphalt roof.
Really? Wow.
In a very old, that was, you know, what they got back then was what, and under the shingles we found parts of the old roofing, and that was the decision, much to the consternation of much of the, not the staff so much, but the public that, you know, for a long time was, why did you tear down that beautiful old
shingle cabin? Oh, my gosh. Huh.
And, but we had very clear pictures, and I, you know, it was, to me, an interpretive issue. This is the way it was.
So, Alan, and, yeah. I'm sorry to keep interrupting here, but when I think of tar paper, today, if I'm doing my roof at my house, I pull out the shingles, I pull off the tar paper, which is a 3-foot-wide roll of asphalt impregnated paper, and I roll that out. But I roll it out on a plywood deck. What kind of superstructure did they have underneath the tar paper? And are you talking about like 3-foot-wide rolls? What was the tar paper like back in the late 1800s?
Well, it seemed like, well, I don't think we had any from that date, but we definitely had where it was replaced, because the point was it had to be replaced constantly.
Gosh.
And it looked just like 3-foot rolls of tar paper.
Okay.
And it was... Basically, they had 1x8s or 10s nailed across there
as a deck,
a roofing decking, and then attached this.
Okay.
Now, the interesting thing to me was that the historic architect and the crew agreed that he could get a source of really modern, special, like tar paper, but it wasn't. It was a huge roll, and I've forgotten what it was made for. Like, Boeing made it for something, but it was very thick, and it was covered with sand, you know, grains, and it was nailed up there, but the nail holes were covered, and it looked like exactly like the old original tar paper, but it's this thick membrane up there that's supposed to last 20 years. I won't be around to know, but it has already. And we ended up using that on the roof of the fort and the other cabin out at the ranch, the Johnson cabin. And so they look, what you see today is very close to what it was like from the point they were built on.
Okay.
That was... Yeah, the main thing there was the roof and the logs around it.
So it's kind of like you mentioned that it's a big sheet, so I'm assuming that it covers one half of the roof, and the other side is covered by another half, and they overlap a little at the top.
Right. So, yeah.
Clever.
And you wouldn't really, I doubt if any visitors realize what's there. It's very effective, and I know that it's definitely going to do well to preserve the building. Now, when I cleaned the inside, top and bottom, from hantavirus before they came, there was a loft area past the ceiling. When you went inside, you could see the ceiling above you, but on one end of the little cabin, there was a loft. And up there was one of the largest pack rat's nests.
Oh, my gosh.
And it took me a couple days to disinfect that and remove it all carefully, and I got it up there to where I can clean the rafters and the ceiling and the walls, and everything had to be disinfected. Down on the floor, it was a wooden floor that I knew the park had replaced back in the 1970s when they bought the property, when they first received it.
Okay.
And there was 2 to 3 inches of dirt and sand and rodent droppings on the whole thing. And I cleaned that off.
Wow.
And the thing that we found was that the floorboards that were pine 2x6s, or no, they were 1x6 tongue and grooved.
Okay.
Boards there. I found out later they hadn't been treated with anything.
Oh, wow.
So the first time it rained, they buckled, and they were all, you know, really difficult to walk across the floor without tripping and falling down. And there was a good half inch or more of, you know, there was a cup in the middle of each board, and on each side it was, the edge was lifted up. And I asked, you know, that was going to be one of my projects, was to repair that, and I asked if I should just sand it down, and we agreed that that was not going to be too feasible because it had been nailed down before.
Oh.
And since it was a modern feature, just take it out and do it again. So I readily, you know, that was fine with me, took it off and found under there that the first park renovation had put concrete piers under the flooring.
Oh.
Hmm. Like, you know, the cone-shaped 4x4, and there was the floor joists were all 4x4 or 4x6 across the building.
There. Okay.
And then there was a 3/4 inch plywood sheathing, and then this floorboards.
So pretty and substantial floor there.
Yeah, yeah. It was great, and we were happy to find it like that because there was no termites, no problems. It was dry under there. And
Did you pull the whole thing up? Did you pull up the 3/4 inch plywood?
Yeah.
Okay.
And we checked the whole thing.
Nice.
Put it back.
Okay.
And then I installed the flooring, but I weather treated it on the bottom. Well, in fact, I weather proofed all the stuff underneath there. That's mainly why I took up the floorboard.
Okay.
Was to waterproof it, and then I
Was that with something like a Thompson's water sealer or what?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
That's what it was, I think. Yeah, it was commercial. I was just thinking of what was that called, and it is Thompson's water seal.
Okay.
And water sealed the bottom of the plywood and the top and the bottom of the floorboards, and put the tongue and groove floorboards back in again, and I waterproofed that. And well, what I did was finished it with a satin floor coating, a lacquer, you know, for regular floor coatings. But and that was it turned out beautiful. It was everyone that came in and staff. In fact, all the staff and the people inspecting it said, do you have time to come and do my floor? Because it was gorgeous. And
oh, my gosh.
We all discussed, you know, we can't leave it like this.
It's so too pretty. Yeah.
What I did was the dirt from the area around it, I just throwed a bunch of shoveled soils in there, swept them around, and none of my biggest hiking boots got them really dirty out in the orchard, came in and just stomped all over it and would sweep it off and then do it again and basically got rid of the lacquer shine. And it looked just great. It ended up turning out perfect.
So, Alan, I'm curious about this flooring. Was redone in 1970s, but when you headed into it 50 years later, there was a couple inches of dirt there, and I got to thinking, yeah, that can be a really windy place, very dusty, and if there's a door open, which typically there might be, or even closed, but doesn't close super well, and there's some vents maybe up above, the 2 inches of material you shoveled out would have been 2 inches of material that had blown in and built up over time.
Yeah, and if you can imagine a big sandstorm like a haboob coming down the canyon or down the Paria.
Sure.
With the great, you know, whirlwinds hitting those clay hills right next to the ranch there. And just, I saw several. In fact, every year there'd be one or two in the spring where there were just horrendous straight line winds and everything blowing, and I just, you know, would say, oh shoot, now I gotta spend a day sweeping out and dusting all the buildings because there was dust and dirt everywhere. And when we started work, of course, the roof had failed. There was blue sky out there. So any of that dirt and dust came in.
Right.
And the chinking from between a lot of the logs was gone. Were there
windows in the cabin?
Yes.
Okay.
Two windows, and they were original. But I don't know what actual glass they had in the
Okay.
But Johnson's two-story frame house that he built there, Warren Johnson, it had windows, so they had something there.
And I just want to digress for a minute. That Johnson two-story building burned down, is that right?
Exactly.
Okay, yeah. All right. Yeah. Okay, yeah. So what are you thinking? You're like, okay, in 50 years there's going to be 2 inches of dirt here. Do we preserve it for that? Should I put the dirt back, or should I just leave it as this floor?
Oh, well, the plan was to leave it as the floor because there had been attempts all along to, it was when I got there, part of my job was opening the building whenever anyone came up and I'd ask them, do you want to see inside?
Mm-hmm.
They said, sure. So the plan was to definitely have it open to the public. And so I took it a couple steps further, got the floor good. There was an old steel bed up in the little loft that I had to get down to clean everything out and put that back. One of the things that I was really enjoyed was the inside of the building, of the cabin, was whitewashed.
Okay.
The outside was not. And the reason they did the inside was to make it brighter.
Log
cabins were notoriously dark places. So there was quite a discussion back and forth, and the historic architect was saying, you know, I can tell you what they did for that, the original whitewash. We figured that out very well, and do you mind doing that? And I said, no, because, you know, I had, when I cleaned it with the chlorine, Clorox, and water, a lot of the whitewash came down. And so I did whitewash it, and that's a story that I would tell to all of visitors when they came in the building, because they were surprised. Well, look at those beautiful white logs on the inside. And the white, and I told them that's what they did, but the whitewash was lime, milk, and yeah, that's all it was. It was lime.
Just lime and milk. Really?
Yeah. And the milk was to kind of give it, hold it together, so when you painted it up there, it would could stick to the wall a little. With, you
okay.
Know, you got all but heavy cream, but it wasn't. It was just whole milk, as creamy as the better. But I had this feeling that putting all the cream in the middle of the summer on that wall, and I was going to be out of there. It would have really smelled bad, but it didn't. But the interesting part is I had a big brush and 5 gallons of this stuff I mixed up, and we went up and painted on the wall, and it really was a wimpy job. I just couldn't get enough on, and I was thinking, boy, it's going to take 4 or 5 coats to get the nice bright white wash. And what I had the instructions have said, be patient, and because what I found out researching later and what happened was that the when you get the whitewash, the lime, and I also had to tell people what the lime was, and I said I got it up at Ace Hardware because that's the stuff that they make the lines on the football field and the baseball diamond.
Oh, right.
And so everyone immediately said, oh, that's what they use the fat for. You know, it made it, they could make an immediate modern connection
right
to what the pioneers were putting lime on the walls. Well, it's still there. And then after a few days, it started turning white.
Really?
And what happens is the calcium in the lime reacts with the carbon dioxide in the air, forming calcium carbonate.
Okay.
And so you end up with this layer of limestone on the wall, bright white. And you just got to be patient.
How about that?
And I did, and it was, and it worked. And I just, to this day, can barely believe that you just paint it on and go away, and a couple days later, it's brilliant white material.
How so cool is that?
That was fun.
So I think, you know, these days I have a vacuum, and if I have dust bunnies or if there's dust on the part of the log cabin where the top curve of the log is, I just go after it with a vacuum. But back in the day, would that be something that termed spring cleaning? You'd open up the doors and the windows and just attack everything with a broom?
Yeah, and that's what I did, just, you know, to prepare it for the whitewash. I just swept it off really good.
Okay.
Got as much of the old material off that I could. And then put it on there. And then we wanted it, the building to be, you know, where visitors would come and appreciate it and see it. And it was, that cabin was lived in until the early 70s.
Oh, wow.
And
okay.
One of the caretakers and one of the guys that worked for the last owners, the ranchers, he lived in there. And so making it kind of livable was appropriate. So found a little potbelly stove right in the corner, there was one, but someone stole it over the years. But that's a different story.
Okay.
I set up the bed with an old lumpy mattress, not pretending to be straw or anything, but then a quilt on it that Sharon had made that was very, not fancy, it was very basic. In the ranch house, there was, under all the stuff when I cleaned out in there, there was a sewing machine.
Oh, wow.
A kettle sewing machine, a really old one. So I set up that in the place there, and there was a little original table and a kind of a short bench that was in the building, and cleaned them off and put them back in there. And I got two pictures, one of Warren Johnson and one of Samantha Johnson, and blew them up and put them in frames and put them on the wall so I could talk about, here's the guy that built it and for his second wife, Samantha. And then one of the things only I could been bizarre enough to do, when I was at Pipe Springs in the 60s, and in the fort there was fully furnished with antiques in all the rooms, and on the floors in there, they had rag rugs.
Huh. But
the point of those that actually the ladies that worked in there in period dress, they had over the years made them. And they were not the round braided rugs. They were like a Navajo tapestry, just lines straight across.
Okay.
And you'd warp it. But the amazing thing to me, the loom was out on the porch, and no one had ever used it or knew anyone who could use it. And I looked at it, and all the parts were there.
There was a loom there?
The loom. Yeah.
Wow.
You know, one that you sat at the loom.
Yeah, yeah.
With your feet, you lifted up and down the pedals, and then you put your material through on a shuttle. You could pass it through or throw it through and sit there, and then you'd pound it down. So I made a couple rugs on that loom for the park, and everyone was really enthused, and they could still be there for all I know, but we put them on the floor.
Nice.
Well, jump to 2005 or more, and I decided, well, I could need something in here, because these were typical pioneer Southern Utah floor covering.
Oh, hang on, Alan. You mean the loom? Yeah. The loom was at Pipe Springs.
Yeah.
Got
it. The loom was at Pipe Springs.
Thank you. Okay.
It's out on the porch there. I don't think they've used it since I was there.
Okay.
But I also had really interested in Navajo weaving, and I think I mentioned that I taught a class for the Yavapai College Extended Ed at the high school. But I had a large loom at home that was a standing Navajo type loom.
Okay.
And I warped it and sat in the family room next to the fire and watching TV every night for a few nights. It didn't take very long at all. I wove three rag rugs. And the part that I wondered, you know, where can I get rags? And all of that. And, you know, Sharon and the kids, and some of our friends had old you know, shirts and dresses and pants. But mm-hmm. the majority of it turned out, and I was so glad that I, in the end, I emphasized it. They were kind of, the rugs turned out with these gray stripes, some kind of pattern material stripes, and then green stripes.
Oh, wow.
If you looked at it, you would have said gray and green stripes.
And colors of the National Park Service.
I used all my old Park Service shirts and my green Park Service pants.
Okay.
And wove it into it. And I mean, everyone on the staff just went gaga over that. That
cool.
was the neatest thing they had ever seen.
Cool.
And they were on the floor. So the last 4 or 5 years I was there, we kept the building padlocks, but if I was there or if one of the other interpreters were there and visitors showed up, we would definitely stop what we were doing, go over and say, you know, would you like to see the building? And then I'd open it and depend if who they were and what, I'd just go back to work and they could just spend how much time they wanted. If there were a bunch of unruly kids running back and forth, I didn't really want them jumping on my bed or climbing the ladder up to the loft at the top. So that, in the long story, is what I... Well, it's not everything I did on that cabin. I have to... There was a wooden Dutch door to get into it, and for some reason in 70 that I never knew, could figure out why when they re-hung, there were two doors going into the building.
Okay.
That they put them back on backwards, inside out.
Really?
And there was no reason to, because the one door, well, and I, you know, made a big to-do about it because the places where the hinges were screwed in were right there. It was obvious they hadn't covered that up. And why can't it be correct? So I got permission to take those off, and I attached them correctly to the walls. And then another job I had was chinking all the logs on the outside.
Ah.
Because a heavy rain would get in, and I actually did that before I did that.
What did you use to chink with?
Well, there again, fortunately, the guy who was the historic architect in Santa Fe, told me to look around the building, and sure enough, the old mud chinking that had washed out between the logs was all down there on the ground at the base of the wall, and out maybe a foot or two, and this was all perfect mud, clay. You know, I worked with it, and this is going to be great, so I didn't have to do anything to get new material to redo the logs. And as he said, that's probably what they did every couple of years in the old times.
Okay.
The only difference was I mixed it with a sand soil sealant, which comes out kind of like white glue.
Okay.
You mix in your mud.
Right.
It dries and disappears, like, you know, and it's like if you had used white glue and a bunch of sand and stuck it in, it would harden, and it did, but it was had better characteristics. It was made for that. And so I chinked the whole thing outside, and trying to think whatever else.
And that chinking with the sealant would, because when I think, if I just put mud on it, the water's going to evaporate out of the mud. The mud's going to crack. It's going to shrink.
Yeah.
So right away, it's ready to fall out. and yeah. and or at least let rain in on the top of the where it shrunk. But this sealant would not crack out like that. Is that right?
Right. It was flexible. It was almost like a modern caulking in your vases.
Like a latex kind of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. This was a latex kind of stuff is the way to put it.
Okay.
And also, originally they had mixed grass in it.
Oh, wow.
And so I also mixed enough grass that you could see it on the outside that this was sand and grass. It looked just really good.
Cool.
It's got to be redone occasionally because the logs expand, contract, pieces fall out, and I don't know if it's been followed through.
Sure.
The last thing I'll say, and because basically I was doing this sort of stuff on all the buildings before I got done, but the logs needed to be a preservative on them. And one of the things the crew from Maryland did was they picked it all up and with a garden sprayer, hold about 2 gallons, they just soaked the outside logs over and over till it a couple of days till they just filled it. And the stuff that was the accepted formula, I just cringe to this day. But I saw them doing it every day, and so I, in the end, when they were gone, I did it too.
Okay.
But you'd get a big stock pot that would hold maybe 10 gallons, a big kitchen stock pot.
Okay.
And put it on a Coleman stove outside and fill it with kerosene.
Okay.
And a big block of paraffin wax.
Huh.
And you heat it till the paraffin is completely dissolved, and you stir it up, and it's a very liquid formation. But here you've got this Coleman burner underneath this pot.
Very flammable stuff.
Kerosene, which I think I always did it on a day that the OSHA guy wasn't going to be coming down. I was very, very careful and there was no problem.
Oh, gee.
Then you turned off the flame, you got your garden sprayer, and you, with a coffee can, you'd fill up this hot, and it had to be really hot to keep the paraffin, and then you'd spray it on, and when the paraffin is hot like that, it just soaks into the wood. It just soaks it up.
Huh.
And like I said, they had to go back. The first time, it was probably 3 times. Then when I did it, it just once was good.
I sure wouldn't want to have to clean that garden sprayer.
Oh, no, that was a... I think they threw away theirs, and I think I had one that I could throw away, too. But there were several buildings that had wood on them and wooden frame things that were not painted, but needed that preserving. So it was a job. So
The last thing about this cabin, I was thinking, because people were living in it in the 70s, did they electrify it? Did they bring in some electricity for lights at all?
Well, they did, because the electricity came to Lee's Ferry about 1965, actually.
Okay.
And they put a pole out at the ranch and electrified the ranch house in right within 66, 67, early. Later, they, well, it would have been the same time. They ran a line from the ranch house to, they put in a little pole near this cabin, and there were electric lines going into it. Got pictures of the, in the early 70s, there was electric line coming from the circuit breaker box on the ranch house to the Stavansky's cabin.
Okay.
When the park, the first time they did the renovation there, they removed all the electric there.
Okay.
Which, you know, it, in reality, I would have put it back because there was great discussion for that original evaluation, historic evaluation of all of these three. You know, what do you do with these buildings? There was, there are two, well, there's actually three things that the park has done over the years for log cabins, historic buildings, anywhere you go in the mountains. One is disassemble them, move them to an area by a visitor center, and build up a little pioneer village.
Okay.
Of all original buildings, but none of them were in that place.
Hmm.
They came from another place. You interpret them and saying this was going. I got, went to Cage Cove and, you know, over here in North Carolina with a huge pioneer village there that they brought in to protect the buildings.
Huh.
In Yosemite, at Wawona Village, they brought in all the log cabins coming from the backcountry and the low areas, isolated areas, and rebuilt them, put them back together in this little village that they tell the history, but it's unfortunate that they're not where they
right.
belong. The current philosophy is to leave them where they are, preserve them where they are, and
right.
protect them where they are.
Yeah.
Not, and the other huge question is what time period do you restore these to?
Correct.
And see, at Pipe Springs is a good example. That was operating in the 1870s. Families living there. It was the church tithing herd, and they had a dairy. They made cheese and butter that was shipped by wagon to St. George. It was that a lot of the descendants were in the area, and they chose to a particular date, and everything in the place was restored to that date.
Mm, okay.
If there was, if a door had been added later, they took it out and restored the wall. You know, everything back to that date. And it's very effective today when you go there. You're stepping into the 1870s. At Lee's Ferry, though, the history keeps going and going and going. And all the back to the parts of the historic district have long stories, and every one of them evolved.
Hmm.
Even Samantha's cabin is a good example. It was built as a pioneer log cabin. It was rehabbed as a, well, they even had a schoolhouse in there. And they then had the caretakers living there right up to when the park got us. But the other thing is, well, the decision was made in the end to, we're going to interpret the evolution of the structures. And they are going to basically being more or less the way the Park Service got them.
Oh.
On that day.
Hmm.
And, but that was pretty flexible because we could step back a little, and it was more like when the park, you know, before them, whatever it was. But the problem, well, that I would hear all the time was the Johnson family would have financed us rebuilding Warren Johnson's two-story frame Victorian house.
Right.
In a minute. And the problem, that would be great, and that would be a marvelous thing, but the problem was that, like, the ranch house next to it, the Weaver Ranch, wasn't there when we would create an environment that never existed.
Right. That's right.
You'd have, you know, rebuild the schoolhouse up 50 yards away there. Well, it wasn't there when the other things were built there. The decision is very strong now from the park of not creating an environment and a display, whatever, that never existed.
Right.
So, in effect, I would just tell the Gunsons, sure, we'll build you can rebuild that house, but we'll have to tear down the Weaver Ranch.
Exactly.
Which is just as important historically. So, there's a lot of, you know, there was always a question, how far are we going to take this? As what is it going to look like to the public when we're done?
Right, right.
And all. So. And I did major renovations, constructions, floors up, ceilings down, out inside, outside buildings, on every one of them over the next 5 years. So.
Did that include the Weaver place as well?
We started on the Weaver. The Weaver was a major project coming, and the crew from Maryland was not, that was not part of their program.
Okay.
They did all the older ones. That one, you know, had a good roof, not historic, but a good roof, and it was saved for later. Later, I was able to do a lot of, start the rehabbing that with another guy that worked. And I don't know if we have time to go into any of the other. The wonderful story is about the Weaver Ranch house that I think you get me started, and I could. Well, and I never talked about the water system or the orchard.
Right. So I'm thinking there's. I would like to hear your recollections of the Weaver building reconstruction, and the USGS building up across the street from the fort.
Yes.
To know about that. So.
Yeah.
Let me look at the time here. We've been going 54 minutes here. Do you want to revisit tomorrow and talk about some more of this? Because if you want to talk about it, I want to hear it.
Okay. I hope it's significant stuff. I'm trying to focus on, you know, what goes into restoring a historic building.
Right. I think this is important to do this. I mean,
and
I've,
the
yeah.
politics of the park, too.
Well, that's all wrapped up in this. So
yeah.
It's kind of neat. Okay, well, I tell you what, let's conclude part 19 here. We'll put a comma in the interview series. And this will conclude, as I mentioned, part 19 of a Grand Canyon Oral History with Alan Malmquist. Today is Wednesday, August 23rd, 2023. My name is Tom Martin, and once again, Alan, thank you so very, very much.
Thank you, and mainly thank you for being so interested in this stuff.
Well, you're very kind. All right, hang on.